Welcome to Positive Personal Power with hope, aspiration, and encouragement. Our goal is to build and enhance people's confidence and strength to handle life's challenges. Now, let me introduce you to your host, Nathaniel Skula.
So today I'm actually joined by Lewis Moody, and Lewis Moody is known as Mad Dog. And welcome, Lewis.
Hello, mate. Hello. You know what? I've not been called Mad Dog for a number of years now, but it's taken me back to my playing days, which seem like a distant memory, sadly.
Yeah, I can understand that. And I'm also very privileged to be joined by Michael Tobin, OBE. And did you go to Antarctica together for this trip to the South Pole?
Yes, we did. Hi, Nat. How you doing? Hi, Lou. Yeah, we did actually. Lewis was convincing enough to manage to get me to come along, and we left on New Year's Eve, didn't we? Well, I think you left a day or two before that, and I left on New Year's Eve, which really delighted my wife that she had to cancel her New Year's Eve party. And then ended up trudging through incredible challenges personal and physical, and coming out of it and getting back just before lockdown, just before COVID lockdown, actually, and raised a fantastic amount of money for Lou's passion. I'll let him tell you about in a minute, but raised a lot of money as well.
Super, yeah, super. You've been doing really well, Michael, with your fundraising things, initiatives over the past few years. Quite admiring, really. Very, very good.
Well, so Lewis is amazing as well. Honestly, I don't know how he gets the energy to constantly do all the things he does as well.
Brilliant. Yeah, I mean, so Lewis, before we get into anger management, because I know, you know, I want to get into that, right? Get to the nitty gritty, yeah. But I think it'd be good to sort of talk a little bit about the Lewis Moody Foundation, because I know, you know, obviously you're not playing rugby professionally anymore, right? So is this your main thing that you're up to right now, or?
Oh, well, so it's one of the main focuses in my life now. It's certainly, you know, I retired back in 2012, and it does seem like a distant memory. So hung up my playing boots, and I got a letter in the post from a chap called Graham Stark, and his son had a rare illness at the time. And anyway, getting to know Joss, who's Graham's son, I started a friendship with the family and Joss, and took a training session, all sorts of things. Anyway, and about a year and a half later, sadly, Joss passed away. And my wife and I wanted to set up a charity focused on supporting people with that struggle and suffer and deal with brain tumours, and support young families through the challenging times they have to deal with. So, you know, that young man, who was Joss Rally Stark, you know, gave me, in hindsight now, sort of looking, six years on from when we set up the foundation, when actually it was 7 years this week that Joss passed, 6 years since we set up the foundation, a letter asking for help for Joss and meeting Joss. And Joss never asked for help, obviously. You know, he was just the brave, you know, enigmatic, engaging, happy ray of light that he was. But his dad asked me for help. And actually, ironically, you know, Joss and Graham ended up giving me more help in my post-playing days than I could ever have given them. The purpose that setting up the foundation, and, you know, off the back of meeting Joss, it's just given me this purpose, you know, that I've in hindsight suddenly had over the last 6 years, that if I hadn't met this young man, this brilliant young chap, that, you know, I probably wouldn't have had, and I would have been even more lost than I have been at times in the, you know, in what is the vacuum post your professional career, mine rugby, obviously, for whatever sportsman is out there or whatever job, I suppose. But so I've been very lucky, and it's been an absolute passion. And Mike you know, was singing my praises earlier, but, you know, singing his, he's supported the foundation from day one and has been, you know, pivotal in its success, but has also been crazy enough to come on some of the idiotic challenges that I am inviting him on, trying to engage people with. And you mentioned the South Pole. So it was an incredible challenge, awesome group of people, and we raised a lot of money.
That's super. So you didn't run 40 marathons in 40 days, Mike, with Lewis then?
No. So I tried to get him at least on one or two, but, you know, he was too busy throwing a rugby ball. I tell you what he did do, though. We had a little rugby match on at the South Pole. And funny enough, Lewis is the only person that I'm aware of that's actually played rugby at the North Pole and the South Pole. Is that right, Lou?
Mate, I believe so. I don't like to brag about it, but as far as I know, yeah, it's pretty cool, huh? Just taking a rugby ball was probably the biggest challenge, trying to fit it in our kit and transport it all those days, and then actually blow it up. But yeah, it was a lot of fun.
That's cool. Yeah, it sounded like a brutal trek to Antarctica, really. From what Mike was telling me, you know, it's like it's tough, right?
Mate, it was really tough, but it was, I think, you know, when you look at pictures and you reflect on challenges that you've done, you often just remember, and I sometimes think about this from my playing career, is that when you cast your memory back, sometimes you just remember the end result, you know, it's getting to the finish line, whether it's the South Pole, or, you know, having that medal put around your neck, if it's a World Cup final or Premiership or a Heineken Cup, whatever. And you often forget the journey and the hardships and the struggles and the challenges that each individual goes through, because, you know, no matter who you are, and we had some incredible leaders on our trip, you know, Alan and Wayne, who, you know, Marines, Special Forces, they've been there, done it all. You know, everyone has a struggle on some day, and it's how you come together as a team and how you support each other to get through those days that really interest me and really are the moments that I try and reflect back on as much as possible, because when you get to the end, it's, you know, it's brilliant, it's the moment that probably sticks in the memory longest, but actually trying to remember the journey and how hard it was, and the, you know, the blisters, the altitude sickness, you know, the fatigue, the frost nip, the wind chafing, you know, your skin's peeling off left, right and center. I mean, just dealing with the, you know, going to the loo in itself just becomes, you know, one of the most
That's a real memory you don't want to bring back.
Oh man, I just remember watching, you know, listening to people going outside to the loop, because everything you take now, you've got to bring back with you as well. Sorry, if you go going for number two, you've got to collect it afterwards like a doggy bag. And you know, listening to people in the morning and sneaking out of their tents, you know, knocking the frost off the zips, and, you know, with multiple layers on, and then trying to remember the order in which they have to quickly get their gear down, get the plastic bags out, get the loo roll ready, take your gloves off so that your hands don't go down with the cold too quickly, you know, get all your gear back on, then hope your poo bag hasn't blown away and you're going to chase it with your trousers around your ankles. That has happened to a couple of
-20 degrees. Yeah.
We can laugh about it now, but it's hard.
That's awful. Mike was telling me about the the wet wipes. He brought some wet wipes with him, and he was like, it's pointless. They're just like frozen solid, weren't they?
Yeah. They were just scrapers in the end.
Yeah, from previous experience, I didn't take the wet wipes. The other, you can only bring wet wipes if you keep them in something very warm, which is normally near your crotch. So it depends where you've got room to fit those. So, you know, I just don't have more room.
Oh, dear. It's hard to talk about anger management now with you two guys. We should have started round the other way, didn't we? Really?
But do you know what's interesting is when for me, like playing sport, and I don't know whether it's the same, you know, in the business world, but a lot of people I meet since retiring find it really difficult to, so if they saw me as a player and they didn't meet me, they didn't know me from Adam off the pitch, they find it sometimes very difficult to marry the two individuals, you know, because for me, when you cross the white line playing, you know, rugby, you're entering sort of a combat zone, a combative environment.
Yeah.
where you're testing each other physically to the max, and I cannot operate, you know, I could never have operated as a rugby player, as a sort of laid back, you know, softly spoken individual that I am off the field. Mm-hmm. I could never operate like that and have a successful career if I was that individual on the pitch. And so I look at a number of sports persons and, you know, look at Michael Jordan and Magic Johnson and all those sorts of people. You know, they all have split personality. So I'm not comparing myself to those two absolute legends, by the way. But it was just the name that sprung to mind. It was, you know, you've got Magic Johnson, you've got Air Jordan, guys that had sort of nicknames that, you know, lived maybe beyond their actual name. And, you know, I had this mad dog persona that, that was created because, you know, I saw the game for me was about protection and loyalty to whatever team I was playing with on that day. And that meant that I would do and give whatever it took to benefit those guys around me. And on occasion that meant, you know, I went to sort of emotional levels that maybe other players didn't. And I think when I played, and that nickname came about from the manner in which I threw myself around the pitch with a sort of healthy disregard for my own personal well-being most of the time, you know, throwing myself into boots and feet and, you know, all sorts. But so I think people find it difficult to marry the two individuals, but you have to be like that to play professional sport, in my opinion, anyway. You have to have sort of almost a split personality, whereas, you know, I couldn't operate as the mad dog in normal life, you know, running down shopping aisles, smashing people through the fruit and veg stand. You know, apparently that doesn't go down too well in the normal,
life. It was almost binary, wasn't it? When you walked off, you'd go and have beers with the other players, right?
Yeah, and it's just, it's difficult to explain if you're, you know, when you're not in that professional environment. But I think it must apply to all professions, you know, to a degree, that there is, you know, when you're in the working environment, which is, you know, I played the majority of my career at Leicester Tigers up in the Midlands, you know, very successful. We had a big banner outside the changing room when we went into the club that said, "Welcome to work." So that's how we approached it. And I think, you know, in any working environment, you are, you know, like Mike Tobin, CEO, I'm sure, you know, is not exactly the same as Mike Tobin, you know, the husband, the dad. You know, there are sort of different roles that you fulfill because you you adapt and you understand what it's going to take to be a CEO, and you understand what you need to be a dad. And for me to be a rugby player, I needed to be, you know, a fully competitive, you know, emotional wrecking ball. You know, that was what I could give to my team. You know, I was reasonably skillful. I wasn't the most skillful player in the world, but I could give them, you know, raw passion, desire and commitment. And I used that as a means of sort of getting people maybe inspiring is the wrong word. I like to think that I inspired people through my actions, but that often meant that I ended up on the wrong side of the referees and some of the players as well.
Yeah, I think any contact sport. Like I used to do a lot of wrestling and in Tai Chi. Yeah, so like in the British Championships, as soon as you get on the mats, you switch something in your head. Just you're fully present, aren't you, in the moment, right? So I kind of get it, right? And but like when you're really angry, yeah, like. you can't manage it, right? Like you just go crazy. Yeah
very much. I mean, look, I can if I look back at my career, and actually, I mean, this may surprise a lot of people, but I only ever had one red card in my 16-year professional career.
Wow.
Yellow cards were slightly more frequent to come by, but red cards there was only one. And
just happened to be playing for England at Twickenham. Yeah,
just happened to be a rather inopportune moment. And, when we were, in front of 90,000 people at Twickenham. You know, I don't know what the right word is. Is it ignominy or, you know, I have the great pleasure of being the only Englishman in the history. Well, this was until 2016 at the time. So in 2005, 2006, the only Englishman in 100-year history of the RFU to be sent off at Twickenham.
Wow.
You know, Johnny kicked a drop goal. I mean, I've got that record. Brilliant. But you know, you look back, and when you put my name into YouTube, and when you know some of my kids' mates, you know, looking me up and saying, "Your dad played for England," you know, did he really? And I'm trying to convince them that I was a pretty good rugby player, and they type my name into YouTube. Literally, the only thing that comes up is me fighting Alassana Tuilagi at Twickenham, who played for Samoa. And it's literally like I just had one big brawl my entire career. That was it. They would not believe that I actually scored any tries, did any, played any decent rugby. But now, in answer to your question, is that you're talking about the emotional angry state, is that what I recognized, so after that incident in particular, and talking about anger management, I never ever thought I had any form of anger management issues whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And it was only after that incident in 2005 against Samoa, getting that red card against Alex, who was actually my teammate at Leicester as well, but playing for Samoa on that day.
So, oh, wow.
Another sort of topic to discuss. But it was only after that, you know, incident that I sort of, I tried to take stock and look at, you know, what had gone wrong, because, you know, people come up and give me abuse in the media saying I should have my contract, you know, cut up, and, you know, all sorts of things, you know, that I was a disgrace, and, you know, all these sorts of comments. So I need to reflect quite harshly, because I never mm-hmm. saw myself as a violent person. Competitive, you know, aggressive, yes, but never violent. And actually what transpired, so during the course of my career, so in 2002, I had my first shoulder operation, my first operation. And that was, what, 4 years, 5 years into my playing career. So that's pretty good going. And from that point onwards, I literally had a run of injuries that took me through to the end of my career in 2012. Mm-hmm. And but up until 2005, I had a number of injuries. And what I realized was that, in hindsight, and after a lot of people going, "Mate, I think you need anger management," and I'd be going, "What are you talking about? I don't need you need anger management." okay, maybe I do.
But okay.
I looked at it and I saw a brilliant sports psychologist called Jamie, whose name surname I've completely forgotten now, and he'll chastise me.
Don't worry, I can drop that in the notes. If people are in sport and they need help with their anger, we can drop that in there. So no problem, yeah.
But he was really good, and I had lots of chats with him. Now, I don't know what you're like or Mike, but I always thought that seeing a psychologist was a sign of my own personal weakness to a degree, that I couldn't deal with my own stuff. So when I finally did sit down with him, it just made me realize that actually, do you know what, seeing a sports psychologist is another way of training. Like it's, mm-hmm. you can train your muscles, right, to be quicker and stronger and sort of jazz and more powerful.
Yeah.
You know, this was just another way of training my brain to adapt and overcome the challenges that it was dealing with at that time. And he just gave me a couple of quick tools, which essentially was a distraction mechanism from the emotion I was dealing with, a little bit like a child, right? So, mm-hmm. you know, for anyone that's got kids, you know, the emotional connection that kids have is very difficult for them to disengage from. I know my youngest son, you know, goes through this as well. And actually, if you treat it with anger and you continue on with it, it will just get more emotional. And actually, mm-hmm. often what you need to do is distract. Certainly works for my son, and actually really worked for me on a playing front.
Right.
But the realization is why I became angry was I had a huge number of injuries from 2002 to 2005. And because I got frustrated about not being able to play this sport and watching my teammates do it week in, week out over months and whatever weeks and mm-hmm. months I was out, is that the frustration manifested itself in violent acts when I returned on the pitch, because I had all this emotional and physical energy to release. Mm. And it would come out in the wrong ways. And because I hadn't learned the sort of emotional control to handle it when it did come out. So it was really useful to sit down with Jamie and understand that and realize that, because I would have bluntly and stubbornly carried on, you know, not seeing any psychologists until I retired, probably had that moment not happened. So it was a really good lesson for me. And I don't know if you guys, if that resonates with either of you too, but.
I think it's a very important thing to actually recognize that you can get sort of assistance like that, right? I mean, it's great the way you kind of looked at it. It's just another part of training, mm-hmm. because you know, I think especially in men, we tend to see the need for that sort of help as being a real weakness in ourselves. And, you know, why that would be when, you know, we're happy to go to a gym and see, you know, that we need help in building another muscle. You know, it's really interesting why the male psyche in particular suffers like that.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense, actually. I mean, I think as you get older as well, you learn to kind of deal better with your emotions, you know, like, and take some time out, you know, but sometimes you just, with all that testosterone as well. Yeah. Like if you're pumping weights and you're doing all that, it's a combat sport. I mean, you know, really that's how I look at rugby, right? Like it's combat. Yeah. All right. You might have a ball, but it's still combat. Yeah. So that's how I really like
the way that, you know, as you said earlier, that you can kind of walk on. It's almost like when you pass that white line, you know, it's a different person. When you come back off again, the same person you've been sort of, you know, bashing against for 90 minutes or 80 minutes in this case is kind of, you know, you go and have a beer with them. And you know, that's something that resonated when you hear Jono and people like that talking. You know, it's always the same. You told me once at Leicester that, you know, you didn't feel like you'd had a proper training session unless you'd had a punch up on the fields.
Hey, you know, you laugh about that. We are so true. I was with Jono the other day, and we always discuss this whenever I'm with any of the old Leicester and England boys, and you know, Leicester in particular. We just absolutely, like, it was the competitive nature. We were so competitive as individuals, yeah. And I think we had such good players around us that there was a competition for place. You know, there was a deep competition for place in terms of the number of players that were able to push to play. In terms of the quality, and that meant that training would lead to some, you know, you've got all these sort of macho, you know, alpha males strutting around like peacocks, wanting to be in the first team. Some of them are in the second team, some of them aren't even, you know, they're in the wider squad.
Yeah.
And when you get the opportunity to play against each other, you know, Wednesday defensive sessions when you just had to, you know, it would always end up in a fight. And as Mike said, you know, invariably we only felt prepared, you know, physically ready if we'd had
unless
to fight.
Unless your own teammates.
Yeah. We loved it. It was a sign that, you know, it was a sign. Yeah. That, and, it, you know, it makes no sense now because obviously the violent side of the game is all in the collisions and the power and the you know, the force of the hit. Whereas back then, obviously, there were slightly different elements of the violence that came in. But we all reveled in it. We loved being that sort of brutish side that didn't take any crap off people or off each other. And I think, you know, you look at those anger management issues, you look at a lot of the guys that I played with, you know, would have that emotional, you know, that need to get to an emotional state. It's like in the change rooms beforehand, you know, you talked about the combative nature of the game, you know, brutal conduct. It is. And actually, yeah. you were taught to hate the opposition from an early age. Mm-hmm. And you almost want to create that because you've got to go out and be prepared to tear strips out of them and do whatever it takes to a degree, obviously, to win that game. Because at the professional level, you know, results are everything. Winning is everything. And, you know, we, as an individual, you have to find a level that is right for you. And sometimes you will go beyond that level, and that may manifest itself in, you know, acts of violence on the pitch. Sometimes it may have the opposite effect, actually, if you're overly emotional pre-game, or you're overly mm-hmm. fired up. Actually, you can deplete your energy resources so much that during the course of the game, you're no use to anyone. So right. Understanding those emotional levels that you have to reach and deal with is, you know, is a challenge in itself, and it takes some time to get there. But I think, you know, listening to both of you just mention, you know, about dealing and coming to terms with, I think, speaking about your own challenges. So for me, you know, growing up in an era at Leicester and in a rugby environment where it is very macho, and actually admitting any form of weakness was a sign of weakness and something that would be jumped on, and, you know, you'd have to, you know, defend yourself for the coming foreseeable future. So actually, you never wanted to give up any weaknesses, but that in itself was weakness, right? You know, now that we're all slightly more enlightened, maybe I'm older and wiser, and the world is going in a different direction. Actually, suddenly being able to share that information. Now, I had I was diagnosed with ulcerative colitis in 2005, which is a bowel disease. Wow. And I didn't speak about that for 2 years, which is insane, right? Because you don't speak about it. You just pile pressure on your own shoulders. And people don't understand why you're late for meetings, you know, why you're rushing off from a training session, why you're, you know, why you're having to get to training an hour and a half early, and, you know, when the great gates are shut and the cleaner's the only person, all these sorts of things actually just pile pressure on pressure. And actually, when you start speaking about things, you realize that people are much more forgiving, much more accepting.
Yeah, understanding is almost all the battle, isn't it? I mean, once you realize, you know, once you sort of sit in someone else's position for a while and you realize what they're going through, then of course you're going to be more empathetic and sympathetic to them.
And I think finding tools. For me, the key for dealing with, you know, anger issues was finding tools to cope and mechanisms, you know, to that would work for me. And at the time, you know, sitting down with Jamie, you know, and it seems stupid now because it seems so simple, but just a distraction technique. So he gave me three pieces of information pre-game. Well, sorry, there was two different areas. So one was the initial dealing with the initial emotion of, let's say, I'd been sent off against Twickenham, so I was probably going to be targeted by players when I came back to playing. So how did I deal with that when that sort of red mist descended? Right. And the distraction was literally my first thought, instead of looking the person that did it in the face or trying to find him, was look the ref directly in the eyes, and it would distract just long enough to make my thought process change. And because it would then be right, what's the ref's next decision going to be? It's going to be based on my actions. So, mm-hmm. you know, do I want to put the team in a worse situation by reacting no matter what's happened to me? And it just, you know, all it takes is that split second, and all of a sudden your emotional disconnect changes and you can be more rational. And I never, you know, bizarrely, I never received a yellow or red card from that moment wow. onwards, which is amazing. But the other part that he gave me was almost in the other respect. So it was towards the latter stages of my career, I found it hard to emotionally get to the level I needed to perform, if that makes sense, because we went from playing in front of 80,000-90,000 people in World Cup finals, or two World Cup finals and Heineken Cups, and all these amazing teams and matches, to playing, you know, when I moved down to Bath, to playing in front of like 8,000-9,000 people, I found it much harder to get mentally ready for the game. Mm-hmm. And he again gave me some really useful tools, which was three examples. So one was a piece of music that was very personal to me, mm-hmm. a object that was only personal to me, and symbolic and everything, but deeply personal to me. And then a memory, and he called it a world-class moment. So he said, what is your world-class moment? When you look back, when you were playing your absolute best and you feel you were the best player in the world in that position, or the best version of yourself in that position. And he said, take those three elements. So for me, it was the Foo Fighters, My Hero, which is an awesome song. If anyone's ever heard it or never heard it, go find it. Dave Grohl, absolute legend. And the object was my namesake. So my great-grandfather, Lewis Walter Moody, give you an idea of my nickname as a kid, was John Boy and Mary Lou from the Waltons.
But,
so he was...
The Waltons. I remember the Waltons. Awful. It was awful. Yeah.
But anyway, he was a soldier, and he went over with the British Expeditionary Force in 1914. And was a part of the first group of soldiers to meet the Germans, and I've got his First World War medal. So that was the object I had, and
wonderful.
And then the other thing was with the world class moment. I used to take myself away for 2 minutes pre-game every game. Mm-hmm. Listen to that music, listen to that My Hero song, clasp the First World War star in my hand so tightly that it sort of punctured the inner parts of my palm. And it was just enough, combined with that, you know, visualization of me hitting my world class moment, that took me to the level I needed to be at to play the remaining, you know, few seasons of my career. So it was not only...
You should do that every game, Lou.
For the last couple of years, yeah, with England, with Leicester. Sorry, not with Leicester, with Barton, with Bath, yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah, was fascinating.
That's really interesting, because it's like you. So basically, you're just distracting yourself from the emotion that you that you're going through, aren't you? To kind of just get in the state that you want to get into, right? Is that how you would describe it? Or
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think you're probably right. Yeah, I don't know whether it's a distraction. Certainly, the first is a distraction. You know, in terms of dealing with the immediate emotion of. You know, something that's happened on the pitch.
Yeah.
You know, the second, in terms of getting to an emotional state of readiness,
is
almost like it's slightly contrived, because you know that you're going to go do it. Mm-hmm. You're not having to deal with a reactive response. You know you're going to create a level of emotion, you know, related to these three moments. And I did that, I don't know what, so 18, 19, 20 times over the last year and a half of my playing career. But it was really... it was really beneficial in terms of getting me to where I need to be. And I suppose the point of it is, you know, that in itself is not going to apply to everyone, but is actually going out there and finding the tools. You know, I could have quite happily just carried on and underperformed in the latter stages of my career and not recognized the importance of understanding your own emotional intelligence and how emotional.
How much do you think Annie's played a part, your missus has played a part in that kind of process over the years?
Oh, that's a good question, mate. I think having a support network for me, a completely trusted support network. We met when we were 19, so she came through my entire career. And she was able to sort of ground me in some of the darkest days, you know, without being too dramatic. You know, when you've had your third operation in 12 months and you come back, you're playing out your skin, you then break another bone and you're back to square one. And, you know, she was there to pick up the pieces, but also at times, you know, give me, I remember, I tore an Achilles during the 6 month rehab for that. I then found I'd torn all the cartilage off my hip. So I needed a hip microfracture. I was then out for a year and a bit. I got back, you know, with all the worries about would I get back into the Leicester side, would I get back into the England team, would I get back at all? Start playing out my skin, which was amazing. Great, you know, attributes to the physios and all the guys that worked with me. And then 6 weeks later, I'm being called back up into the England squad in training, just playing touch rugby, dived on a loose ball. And Alex Tuolangi, who I had that punch up with, he, I don't know whether this was payback, but he tripped over me. And, you know, just totally freak accident, landed on my ankle, snapped it in two places. So having been out for a year and a half, had the joy of coming back for 6 weeks, getting back into all the sides and on form. And then it was the only time in my career I thought, nah, I've had enough, I'm retiring. I was 28. I just thought, I cannot go. Must have had 10 operations at that point. I cannot go through the rehab, the pain of the monotony of just rehabbing, you know, again and again. And I called Annie, my wife, and just said, look, I've had enough, I'm going to retire. And she said to me, she was like, yeah, that might sound strange to some people, but she was like, don't be so stupid, in slightly more colourful language. and she sort of said, she alluded, because I was in tears at this point, you know, and there's not, and I don't mean this to sound macho or anything, but it's not often I'm drawn to tears. And she was like, look, don't be so stupid. You know, you've got the rest of your career. You've got a broken ankle. That'll take you 6 weeks to recover from. Just, you know, stop being so soft. Just crack on with it. You'll be fine. And that might sound harsh, you know, and the language that she used was slightly more direct. But it was, I suppose what it was actually, it was really a appreciative moment of, I was feeling unnecessarily sorry for myself. Yes, I would actually be back in 6 weeks, because it was a broken bone. It would heal. Okay, it needed plates and what have you, but I would come back from it. It was just like a slap in the face to go, mate, stop feeling sorry for yourself. You'll be fine. You give up now.
Yeah.
You know, you miss the next 5 years of your career. You would have missed another World Cup, would have missed captain in England, all that sort of stuff. So
wonderful.
You know, it is amazing. You know, so I know Annie's that sort of character that's got real sort of steel as well in the way that she sees the world. And I think you two complement each other so well. When I was doing my 40 marathons on day 38, on day 37, instead of doing 26 miles, I did about 34 because of the route that I was taking around companies that had sponsored me that day. And it was the hottest day of the year. And I woke up on day 38 and I said to myself, you know what, I've probably done 40 in distance over the 37 that I've done. And I said, no one's going to worry about me not finishing this. You know, it's just really not a problem. And I was getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning and Shalina was coming out with me, my wife, for sort of half an hour, first half an hour of the run every morning. Yeah. And then making me ice baths and massages and things when I got back. And like when I said this on day 38, she looked at me, she said, same sort of thing, very, very colourful. And it's like, I haven't put up with 37 days of crap from you, getting up with god-awful hours and doing all this stuff just for you to finish now. Because yeah. You know, but in 6 months, you'll regret it and you'll want to try and do the bloody thing again. And I won't be helping you then. So, you know, she literally threw me out the door and slammed it behind me and said, don't come back till you're done. But we really, really need these kind of pushes sometimes, right? I mean, you know, it's amazing how valuable that is in life.
It's support network, isn't it? I just think it's having a trusted, you know, support network, whether it's your wife, you know, Shalina in your case, Mark, Annie in mine, you know, whoever it is, whether it's friends, brothers, sisters, just having people, colleagues that you can trust and get genuine, genuine opinions. And
100%. Yeah.
And I think that word genuine is really important as well, because, you know, it's someone that you can actually trust, even if they are being tough, right? Or it appears they're being tough. You know that their bottom line is they're trying to do the right thing for you. And that's that tough love type message is really, really important. If you can get a network of people that will tell it to you in the clearest sort of possible way, but purely for your benefit. I mean, that's a rare and valuable resource.
It's important. There are too many yes men and women in the world, you know. It's like, I'd rather someone gave me the real truth, you know. But so, Lewis, what do you suggest other people do in similar circumstances to, like, overcome their anger like you have?
I think there's a couple. Well, you know, I don't like offering advice.
No, but
I can talk from my own experiences, I suppose, and just say that what worked for me was accepting, actually, because I was in denial for ages that I had any form of issues. When people, like as I said earlier, you know, people were like, mate, you need to address this. I'll be like, piss off, you address it. Like, I haven't got anything wrong. I'm getting angry thinking about it.
Yeah,
and that in itself, you know, then being able to go away and reflect. And go and be open enough and honest enough with yourself to go, okay, look, maybe there is something I need to address, and then accept it, be accountable to it. And I suppose the next thing is finding someone that that you can, or something, doesn't have to be someone, you know, some way of dealing with it and talking about it. And, you know, there's a great quote from the, I think it's that's not a quote. It's the SBS have their sort of strap line is adapt and overcome. And I think, you know, you can overcome anything if you're prepared to adapt. If you're never prepared to change, you're not gonna change. So you'll never change the outcome. So for me, that was it. It was accepting that there was something wrong, or something that needed changing. Didn't need to be wrong necessarily, and then being prepared to go and do something about it. And it's, I suppose it's a degree of, you know, having a degree of humility yourself to be able to go, okay, look, you know, we've all got weaknesses and these are mine. And being able to talk to someone about it was the biggest stepping stone for me. As an only child, you know, admitting you're wrong in anything is quite difficult. So or that you've got any flaws or weaknesses was a challenge. So realizing that then, I think, was really important. And I've then tried to learn a lot more from that in the subsequent years, and how I handle my kids and their emotional challenges and how I react to them. And actually I can get that wrong so many times as a dad. There's so many lessons that I need to reflect on again. But it would be accepting it, I suppose, and figuring out how to overcome it, adapt and overcome.
Yeah. That's like anything in life, right? You got to first of all accept where you are and then try and find the way forward, right? I mean, and whether that's professional help or not, you got to work it out first, right?
Yeah, I think it's like you know, you don't get better simply by you know, saying you're not ill. You've got to recognize you're ill, then you go to the doctors, then they give you medicine, and then you've got to have the balls to take it. So yes, there's a whole load of sort of breakpoints in there.
Yeah. Well, that's been super interesting. I can't thank you enough, both of you, for your time. That's absolutely brilliant. I really, really enjoyed it. And so if the audience would like to learn more about what you're doing nowadays, Lewis, how would they find you?
Well, mate, the simplest way would be to look up the foundation website. So it'd be the lewismoodyfoundation.org. We support projects directly linked to the Brain Tumor Charity. So all the money we raise through challenges. We've got a My Zone Fitness challenge at the minute that people can come and join us on. If anyone fancies taking on any of the challenges that are obviously all postponed at the moment, bar the My Zone Fitness one, we're going to the Amazon in future months, which will be postponed until next year now, probably. But just have a look at the website, come and get engaged and support us wherever you can. You know, as I said, Mike's been brilliant to the foundation over the years, and can't thank him enough. But if anyone wants to come and get involved, then please do.
Yeah, Mike's been a great guest on my other podcast show. And if anyone wants to check it out, it's more of a business kind of podcast instead of this. But it's influentialvisions.com.
Thanks for listening to Positive Personal Power. Do subscribe via your favorite podcasting app and please leave us a 5-star review. Or sign up on our website, positivepersonalpower.net, for weekly emails and updates, and do share our episodes with your friends and on social media. Feel free to reach out anytime.